Do you ever just want to hear how the famous found fame? How the poor man became a millionaire? How risking comfort gave someone more freedom? Honestly, do you ever just wonder if everything will be okay? Welcome to the Y'all Podcast, where everyone has a seat at the table. I'm your host, Laura Jean Bell. In this space, I will share stories about life, Jesus, and the South. Stories of the past and the ones that are still being written to instill hope without fear of the future. Meet with me around the table, sharing tales about the lives of others, of business and risk and heartache and joy and failure and success. Let go of the fear that hopelessness is your destiny and fill up on the encouragement that mercies are new each day. Because the best thing about a story is that there is a beginning and an end. Today, I feel so honored to welcome this guest on the show, Mr. Joel Salatin. He is the owner of Polyface Farms and the author of countless books, including Beyond Labels, Salad Bar Beef, and Folks, This Ain't Normal. My husband stumbled upon Salatin when we created our backyard garden a few years ago. It was through listening and learning from him that the obsession grew, and Cody was actually able to help me cure what I thought for years was just an egg allergy. From there, our family has slowly transitioned our farm to the methods of the lunatic farmer himself. In the summer of 2020, we had the opportunity to visit and tour his farm with him as our guide. Later, he graciously agreed to let me interview him for the show. Humbled doesn't even begin to describe the feelings. So, without any further ramblings, help me welcome Mr. Joel Salatin. Okay, so first of all, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. I know that you're a very busy man with all the things that you are running and working and doing. So thank you so much for being willing to be on my podcast. And just the way that normally like I start out my podcast episodes is just simply asking you just talk about yourself. Tell us who you are for anyone listening who has never heard your name before, never heard of Polyface Farms. Tell us a little bit about who you are.
Sure. So, yeah, our family owns Polyface Farms here in Swope, Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley. And I'm second generation here. My mom and dad bought the property in 1961 and never made a living from a farm. It was the most gullied rock pile in the community, so the land was cheap. And dad was a visionary with all sorts of cool ideas about animal movement, portable fencing and shelters and direct marketing and all that stuff. And so I came back to the farm full time September 24, 1982. And Teresa and I, we married in 1980, just celebrated our 40th anniversary.
Congratulations.
And so we essentially had a tabula rasa, a raw piece of land, but not a business or going concern. But with dad's, genius prototypes and philosophy in our, on our launch pad, we were able to bootstrap a little farm and stay in business for the first couple of years. It was very, very tight. Well, it's still tight, but it was really, really tight back then. And over the time, we gradually built a brand business and direct marketed. And today, we have about 20 people full-time employed here, servicing about 10,000 families, where we have an on-farm store. And we did service about 50 restaurants. I don't know how many of them are going to survive the pandemic. But anyway, a lot of them will. And
yeah.
And so we have a pretty broad product line that's livestock. It's pastured livestock, so we have beef, pork, all sorts of poultry: turkey, chickens, eggs, ducks, lamb, rabbit, and forestry products. Because we do own a lot of forest land, and we have a sawmill, so we work in the woods as well.
Wow. Okay, so you're a farmer. But within this podcast, what I really like to do is I love for people to just kind of tell the story of how something began, because we all know that everybody has to start somewhere. And that things, normally people who are doing something really great have walked through all sorts of circumstances and seasons within their story. And so if you would just tell us how did this farm happen? And how you ended up in Swope, Virginia, how you started this farm, how your parents came here, all the details of that, kind of building up to where you are today, if you could share a little bit of that story.
Sure, sure. So my dad was in the Navy in World War II, and from an early childhood, he had a dream of having a farm in a developing country. He just thought he was always on to the new edge, you know, the new frontier, whatever it was. And at that time, the new frontier was the Dutch East Indies, it was called at that time. They no longer exist. Latin America, Central America. And he kind of focused on South America. And so he wanted a farm there. But how does a guy with no money and no equity, you know, start a farm in a foreign country? So he got his degree in business administration and went to Middlebury in Vermont and for a semester and got Spanish and then hitchhiked to Mexico. Wow. Spent 6 months with people in Mexico and then came back and sat for the Foreign Civil Service exam for Spanish and passed it the first go through. And then went as a bilingual accountant with Texas Oil Company, later Texaco, off of the Wildcat, the oil Wildcat ventures off of Puerto La Cruz in Venezuela. And this was a high paying job back then. This is, you know, 1947, 48. And in just a few years, he was able to save up enough money to buy. And then he and mom got married. They had met in college. And so bought this 1,000-acre farm in the highlands of Venezuela, and the goal was to have dairy and broilers. We began raising chickens and selling them on the local market. Everything was going very well. But then in 1959 came a junta of Petit Jiménez. It was a revolution there. And, of course, we had left Texas Oil Company, and we were just, you know, American expats out there on the land. And so we were highly vulnerable to the vicissitudes of, you know, politics and insurrection and all that. And Dad had made many of the local farmers angry because he took over their chicken market because our chickens did not have subtherapeutic pneumonia. All the indigenous chickens, because they ran around through squat pots, villages, sewers, and they all had kind of a subclinical pneumonia, a kind of a respiratory infection that manifested itself as snot, nasal drip, you know, off the nostrils.
Wow.
And so, you know, pre-refrigeration, if you wanted chicken for dinner, you waited until the chicken vendor came by your house, and you went out and you dickered with him for the price of a chicken, and you ran so the senoras, shopping, so you'd have the banana man, the pineapple man, the chicken man, the rice man, you know, they'd all come by the door, and you'd buy from these vendors for dinner. And you know, people that think we've got doorstep delivery, and that's the new thing, you know, they have foreign country before refrigeration, electricity. Anyway, so there was enough, you know, whatever, food, agriculture knowledge, indigenous in the community, that the senoras knew that if they ran their finger down the beak of a chicken, the drier it was, the healthier the chicken was. And so that had an effect on the price. And, of course, if a vendor could find clean chickens, of course, the vendor then got a reputation, a brand reputation. Oh, that vendor, you know, he's got the best chicken. And so Dad very, very quickly cornered the market. And the other farmers, of course, they didn't ask him how he was doing it. He was just keeping things clean and sanitary. And of course, they thought it was voodoo and black magic and all this stuff. And so so when the revolution started, we were prime targets for, you know, when there's a breakdown in any semblance of law and order, it gives every kind of ruffian a chance to express their to take out whatever their vengeance is on whoever they want to, because things are kind of breaking down. It's a little bit like our country today, and in the cities. And so, anyway, we basically fled the back doors. The machine guns came in the front door, and tried to get protection. Dad met with every minister at the national level. Couldn't get any protection whatsoever. So finally, the only thing to do was to leave. And so we walked away, lost everything, and walked away, and came back to the U.S. Easter morning, 1961, on a merchant marine ship, and landed in Philadelphia, and began looking for a farm, and looked at numerous ones. Dad still hoping to go back. After things settled down, his heart, he left his heart in Venezuela. He loved the people, loved the language, loved the culture, land of opportunity, and all that. So anyway, he wanted to do a day's drive of Washington, D.C. in case things changed and the embassy called and said, you can come back, that we'd be able to get back immediately. So we looked at an arc from about Lancaster, Pennsylvania, down to the Shenandoah Valley, down as far south as like Raleigh, North Carolina, and ended up on the most gully rock pile in the area here in the Shenandoah Valley. And so that's how we ended up here. And so Dad sought counsel, both public and private counsel from different entities. How do I make a living on this farm? And every piece of advice was plant more corn, borrow more money, build silos, run cows through the woods, all this stuff. Well, this is what it, destroyed the farm, destroyed the land already. So we knew that wasn't the right solution. And my grandfather was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine when it came out in like 1947 or so. And so he always had a big organic garden, compost, and all that stuff up in Indiana. So Dad got a very much an environmental bent from his dad. And so that's the way we started here. We didn't buy chemical fertilizers, didn't buy chemicals. And Dad got on to some early, controlled grazing stuff, went from Andre Voisin and stuff, the Frenchman, and it started inventing some portable electric fencing. We started moving things around and had portable infrastructure, built the shade mobile. When I started chickens when I was 10, and when I was about 13 and outgrew the chicken house, then we pulled down some little pens that Dad had made for my brother's rabbits that didn't work because the rabbits could dig and we couldn't catch them if they got out. And so we put the chickens in there, and voila, pasture poultry was born. And did that all through, through high school. I sold at the local curb market. And loved the marketing and the customer interaction and the retail, the retail market, being able to be a price taker, a price maker instead of a price taker. And then early on, I wanted to be here. I had a love for it, but it was tough to finally make that jump and say, okay, we're going to try to make a living. So Teresa and I got married. We lived up in the attic of the farmhouse. We made an apartment up there with a separate kitchen and everything. So we lived in the attic, and we drove a $50 car. We didn't have a television. If we didn't grow it, we didn't eat it. We had our own firewood for fuel. Wow. We had our own garden for food. And we just lived on, a couple hundred bucks a month. And by doing all that, we were able to actually sock away some money in our first, year and a half of marriage. And I realized a couple of years in, I said, good night. We actually could live on this for a year. And as soon as I made that realization, I handed in my notice at the newspaper where I was a reporter and said, I'm leaving. And of course, everybody in the world, all friends, family, everybody thought we were, except mom and dad, thought we were absolutely insane. And I fully expected to run through the little nest egg we had. It wasn't much, but we were living cheaply. That's the point.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, what we found was that by not working in town, instead of filling up the gas tank once a week, we filled it up once a month. We didn't have to buy good clothes. You know, there were all sorts of these little drippy expenses that happen when you're commuting and you're working in town that went by the wayside. And slippage on the farm stock. I was here for every calf that was born, so if there was a problem, I could help. We didn't lose many calves. Mm. I was here for, every time the weeds grew up in the green beans, I didn't have to wait till the green beans suffered. I could get the weeds when they were small. And you add up all these little slippages, both in savings, money and time, and we squeaked through 1 year, and we still had a little bit of money. We squeaked through a second year, we had a little money. By the third year, we started feeling like maybe we're going to make it. And by the end of the third year, we were pretty confident. By the end of the fourth year, we were very confident. And then it's just been a progressive ladder ever since.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And a part of this podcast too is a lot about the Lord. And Cody and I are strong believers, and we know that in every season of our lives that we walk through, like there are moments that you can mark in your mind of knowing, like, I feel the presence of the Lord in these circumstances, or I knew I had strength from the Lord in these circumstances. Can you maybe share one or two experiences where maybe you can specifically remember, like, I know that God had his hand in this moment or in this circumstance or season?
Yeah, probably the most poignant one was in about 1990, I'm going to say, 95 maybe, mm-hmm. 94, might have been 94. Anyway, I had already written Pastor Poultry Prophets. That was, Dad died early. Dad died in 1988 at 66, which really seems young to me now. And so I was on my, at 31, I was on my own, I still miss him every day.
Yeah.
But his wise counsel and, well, of course, what you really miss is praise.
Yeah.
Nobody ever gets tired of hearing parental praise, right?
Right.
And so I was on my own, and we got some traction. Teresa and I were, we were out here. We were not wealthy. We're not money people. And here, we've been able to kind of bootstrap this thing up. That attracted media attention. What a great story, young couple, no money, bootstraps a full-time living on a small farm. Yeah, that's a great story.
Right.
And so we were getting some media attention, and I was starting to speak at some things, and I'd written a little manual, and then I wrote the Pastor Poultry Prophets book in 1993 after doing the manual in 1991, and we were kind of becoming, it was just the beginning of, being this kind of, gurus of full-time small farm.
Right.
And suddenly, one day, a meat inspection agent knocked on the front door, showed me his great big badge, and he said, "We've just confiscated all your beef at the slaughterhouse. You're accused of selling illegal meat."
Oh, my word. Oh, my goodness.
And that was roughly half. That was half of our year's income.
Oh, wow.
And so you can just imagine. I mean, it's just imagine your biggest, emotional.
Yeah. That's awful.
Anyway, we called our congressman. We called our senator. We called our delegates. We got things started there. And, of course, this is in the days before the Internet, before everything else. Basically,
right.
The guy camped out on our front porch in his car for a week as they conducted their investigation.
Right? Wow.
They made all sorts of demands on us, which we refused. They wanted our customer list. We refused to give it to them. So you can imagine this week of turmoil. Here we are trying to farm and take care of things here. And meanwhile, we're in this with this government agent parked at the front door, and literally parked at the front door. I mean,
he spent days,
okay? Mm. So we come to the end of the week, and of course, I activated our senator, and all of our politicians jumped on it, and were extremely active in it. Long story short, by the end of the week, on Friday, he came in and he said, okay, Richmond and I have all agreed that we're going to just assume that this never happened.
Okay.
Well, during that week, like the second or third morning, I was out moving chicken shelters and just kind of, you know, praying and meditating and thinking, man, we're, you know, here we've told people to do this kind of thing, and here we are. And you know, I'll never say it was an audible voice, but it was so clear to me, just out of the still small voice came that wonderful admonition from Mordecai to Esther in the book of Esther for such a time as this.
Yeah.
I still can't tell the story.
Wow.
Without breaking down, because it was just like a hand reached down at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Said, okay, for such a time as this.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna protect you to take you through, and I've got, you know, in Isaiah he talks about, you know, I have plans for you. Plans for good and not for evil. And I'm not a big Pentecostal, you know, claim it, you know, bring it and brag it. for a conservative fundamentalist to get that kind of such clarity in a moment of crisis was I've never gotten over it and never forgotten it.
Absolutely.
And whenever things get tough, that just keeps coming back to carry me and buoy me through, and that was a great time. And so as it ended up, they backed off, and then we ended up calling for a meeting with them and had our political representatives here, and we then took the offense after this was over and we were done with defense. We took the offense and pushed them to essentially sign off on procedures so that we'd never be put in this position again.
Absolutely.
And it turned out very, very positive. We essentially won every argument that we made. Wow. We even got a letter of endorsement from the federal, you know, the head of federal inspection, and that we were correct. Anyway, it was very good.
That's amazing. You had me tearing up over here. We're both over here getting weepy and chills and all the feelings with that. And those are the moments too, that like, as believers, sometimes you can walk through so many different seasons and you can pinpoint the moments when you really felt the presence of God, like step in and just reassure you that you're going to be okay. I think sometimes for me, I know for myself, I need those moments to just remind myself when I'm in the thick of things and I don't know what the end is going to look like, just to know that everything's going to be okay, just because I trust in a God that's bigger than that.
Now he has been faithful previously, and he will be faithful again.
Yes, absolutely. If he's done it once, he'll do it again. I love it.
Yeah. You know, you hear about, you know, the believers who suffer persecution in foreign countries, and we may be heading that direction in this country as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or you know, you read the stories of the, you know, the gulag in Russia and the atrocities and all that, and those survivors, when they get out and they write their biographies or they write their articles, they talk about, you know, the visits and the presence and the upholding hand from God in those trying times. Mm-hmm. And you can see why persecution makes people stronger. If God reaches down that profoundly in persecution. Hey, I don't want persecution.
Right.
But man, I love that. I love that relationship.
Yes.
You know, it's not all bad.
Yeah. and the mm-hmm. kindness of the Lord just to show up in those moments and just remind you, oh, it's just so good. And it's like, that's what you want people to hear and know when people don't know Jesus and they don't know the gospel. You want people to know those moments so that they can literally, like, truly do what scripture says, like, taste and see that the Lord is good. Like, those are the moments where you are so reassured as just as a believer, at least for me. Like, Cody and I have walked through so many crazy seasons in just our short 6 years of marriage. And man, those moments that we experienced the Lord in that way, like, it's rocked us. And it's kept us secure in moments where we don't feel it. Cause you're not always going to feel it. But anyways, thank you for sharing that. I will tell you, Cody and I first saw you, and heard about you a couple of years ago, kind of transitioning the conversation a little bit about food, because it's interesting. You shared this story about the government coming after you about your meat. because we saw you on the documentary Food Inc. And this was a season of life where I was starving for answers to gut and hormone issues that I had been experiencing since I was about 18. I started experiencing some problems. And Cody always supported me in all of my ventures and different trials of food and medicine and all types of things. But it wasn't until last year that he read Salad Bar Beef. And all of a sudden, Cody cared about the food we were getting, especially the meat that we were eating. We went through a vegan phase. Like, we've done it all. We have tried literally everything to heal my internal issues. I actually can remember going through a Zaxby's drive-thru, and like, Cody talked about your book and I was like, yeah, like, sure. But then we went through a Zaxby's drive-thru and Cody was about to order and he just drives off and he was like, I can't eat this chicken. Knowing what I now know, I can't eat this chicken. Anyways, and I thought, wow, my husband has changed. So we've hopped on this journey of being better. We've actually connected to Travis Yarbrough in Montgomery. Awesome. He's awesome. And he uses your methods here in Alabama where we live. So we've been able to buy from him. But I wanted to know from your perspective, and it sounds like you kind of learned a little bit of this in Venezuela, but when did you notice that food could have been the cause of, like, what was hurting people and making people sick? Was there a time in your life where you started figuring that out? Was it passed down to you? Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I got to realize, you know, our family, you know, I grew up here with Adele Davis, Eat Right to Keep Fit, and I don't know what she was an early food enthusiast that introduced people to you know, non-chemical food, and we enjoyed her. I mean, we made her recipe of, you know, tiger's milk and.
Yeah.
All of our church friends called it Panther Puke, you know. And of course, you know, we were odd in all of our Christian circle. They all thought we were nuts. Yeah. Here at the farm, all of our farm friends were hippies. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, late 60s, early 70s.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I grew up in this very bifurcated universe of these straight-laced, you know, Dominion conquistador mentality, you know, Christian folks on the one hand, and then these, you know, these marijuana hippies on the other. And, you know, it was not until later that I realized what an unusual thing this was.
Right.
That normally people who went to health food stores certainly did not go to church, and people who went to church certainly did not go to health food stores.
Yeah. Wow. I've never thought of it that way.
And that awareness kind of grew on me. And as we began in the early 80s, I mean, again, we started, I left I left outside employment in 1982, but we were already starting to try to direct market things. And of course, I grew up at a little, it was the precursor to today's farmer's market.
Yeah.
On the curb market all through my teenage years. So I was always on message about our food is different, our food is better.
Yeah.
And so from a very, very early age, you know, when you're marketing something, it's all about differentiation. Why should I buy, you know, your peppers and not the other guy's peppers? Why should I buy your chicken, not the other guy's chicken? And so we were eating here at home. We did a non-chemical, we did a compost thing, grew all of our own food, canned a lot, froze a lot. And of course I grew up then selling my stuff and hearing people say, oh, it's so much better than what's in the store. And this is in the early
70s. And it is better.
And so it has gotten, this is before Tyson Foods, it's before Car, you know,
right.
It's way before, you know, the real onslaught of significant factory farming that we know today. And, and so I grew up with that reinforcement from our folks from my customers.
Yeah.
Wow, this is better. All that. So that's pretty, you know, that was affirming the trajectory that we were on.
Right. Mm. Right. And so this was kind of like ingrained to you. This was the normal way to do things, to care for a farm, to care for animals, all of those things. And I will agree with the people who have said it, the way that you raise your meat and your eggs, all of that, it makes a difference. I actually, Cody, after reading so many of your books and looking at so many things all my life, every time I had eggs, I got sick. I always thought breakfast food made me sick. I couldn't eat it. And then finally, last year, Cody had me try some eggs from the Yarborough Homestead. They raise eggs the way that your farm does. And we got some, I made them for our daughter and she was eating, and Cody just pushed me to just eat one egg and see how it makes you feel. And I planned a day to eat it in case it made me sick. I mean, it would make me sick for a whole day. And I tried this egg one day when I had nowhere to go. Cody was home in case I got sick and he could take care of the baby. And I ate the egg and nothing happened. And I thought, well, I'll just eat one more and see what happens. And I did it again. And the egg was like bright orange. Like it was darker than others. Like it was this amazing thing. Now I get to eat eggs because I figured out the eggs I was eating, the way that they're raised, that's what was making me sick. And so we've been reading your book, Beyond Labels. We aren't finished with it yet. It's incredible. I feel like I'm nodding through it. Like, yes, I've dealt with that. Yes. Oh my goodness. And it's actually helping me in the grocery store right now. But you list off a number of issues that are on the rise due to what's in our food. And you talk about, you know, people don't know. They have no clue what they're putting in their bodies, the junk that's added to our food. Would you just, like, for the sake of some people listening, like, could you maybe share just off the top of your head health issues that can rise from stuff that's added to our food, the fake sugars, the way that cows are raised, chickens are raised, pigs are raised? I mean, does that question make sense?
Do like essentially, I guess, give them a good side-by-side comparison of industry-raised beef, chicken and all that compared to how you raise it, and you know,
and the health benefits, yeah, or what can actually cause health issues because of the lack of it.
Well, let's start with I love your egg story.
Yeah,
because I've heard that kind of story forever. You know, from our own customers, and I mean, we had a lady in the other day. She had a little 6-year-old son with her, and he was extremely small. She said, he's such a picky eater. He won't eat anything. And, you know, he's not thriving. You know, I mean,
yeah,
he's not sick, but he's just, he doesn't eat anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so she got a couple dozen eggs, actually, took them home. She fixed one for her son. He ate it and asked for another one.
Oh, wow.
You know, she contacted me a week later and said, he's eating 6 eggs a day.
Oh my word. Oh my goodness.
And so I think when you start looking at this issue, you've got stuff that's negative in the food. So toxicities, all pesticides are neurological. So when they affect the nervous system of insects and bugs, they're going to carry over into our food and affect. So you have the toxicity, the whole toxin pathogen thing going on the one hand, but then on the other hand, you have a completely incorrect nutrient profile on the other. So you're getting bad stuff, and you're not getting the full good stuff. So you're in double jeopardy, if you will.
Yeah.
And so what we want to do at our farm is we want to not have the pathogens and toxicity on the one hand, so we don't want the bad stuff, but then we want to create a habitat that allows, in our case, the animals to be raised so that they fully express their nutritional apex, you know, instead of being the lowest it can be and still survive, how about let's see how high it can be and thrive?
Yeah.
And so, for example, we participated, I'm going to say 8 years ago probably, with Mother Earth News magazine. They were just tired of praying all the time, come on, food is food, you get the USDA label, a nutritional label, it's the same, it doesn't matter how it's raised.
Yeah.
So we're going to put this to the test. So we were one of 12 pastured egg producers in the U.S. that participated in the study. They sent the eggs out to a lab in, I think it was Oregon, and had them checked and did about 10 nutrients. I'll just pick one of them, folic acid, which is real important for pregnant women.
Oh, yes.
And the USDA official nutrition label on a carton of eggs is like 48 micrograms of folic acid per egg, and ours averaged 1,038 micrograms per egg.
Oh, Moses.
We're not talking about little amounts. So not only do our eggs not have, salmonella and stuff in them, partly because our chickens get fresh air, sunshine, and exercise. They're not packed into a factory house with, 100,000 other birds in fecal particulate contamination that abrades their respiratory tract.
Not only is it not that, but
on the positive scale, they are getting fresh air, exercise, sunshine, GMO-free, genetically modified organism-free local feeds, and, of course, the salad bar, and a completely new new spot to live on every day. They're not eating and living in their toilet every day.
So that's
one. Let's take beef. Beef, of course, starts. All calves are raised on pasture. Pasture up until they go to the feedlot. In the feedlot now, they get corn and soybeans, a very simple ration.
Right.
And they're crammed into these quarters where normally in the desert. And the reason that they have feedlots in the desert, like from Amarillo, Texas, up, through Colorado, Greeley, and the reason they have them in the desert is so they don't have as much mud. But in the desert, of course, it's dry. You got all this manure and urine, and it's just vaporizing. And you can literally, like in California, you go by the feedlots, and you can literally see the pall, the haze pall, up over these feedlots, and it'll go out, it's got just 3 miles.
Wow.
So, for example, grass-finished beef, for example, normally has at least 300% more riboflavin, which is a B vitamin, than corn-finished, grain-finished beef. What's the importance of riboflavin? Well, riboflavin is known as the essential fatty acid that is the calming. It's the calming fatty acid. In other words, it keeps you from going crazy.
And wow.
When a whole culture eats so poorly that its nutritional regimen ratio is missing, it's like a it's like a an eight cylinder car hitting on four cylinders.
Yeah.
And that car is not going to be very functional.
Yeah.
And so a person who is not ingesting the full array of nutrient density is going to be extremely deficient in some pretty important components that then manifest themselves either as health issues, emotional issues, mental issues, all these sorts of things.
Wow.
And so you know, that's one of the critical elements of beef. Chicken, same thing, same issues there.
Yeah.
It's pretty filthy in these big, you know, factory houses. And the fecal particulate actually goes into the skin through the feather follicle. Of course, in the great big slaughterhouses, where they beat them hard with these gauntlet feather pickers, it beats the fecal particulate into the carcass. And so they'll have as many as 40 chlorine baths to try to, you know, sterilize, decontaminate the carcass, you know, as it comes through in a bag. Well, then people that have chlorine and environmental sensitivities, then they get a rash and they've got chicken. And we've had plenty of customers that have had those kinds of environmental reactions to just regular supermarket food. So again, I think if you think of it as pathogen toxicity on one hand, that's the bad stuff. And if you think about it as nutrient profile on the other hand, that's the good stuff. What we're looking for is get rid of the bad and add the good. That's what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty profound that the differences are not just, you know, 10%, 20%. As I illustrated, the differences are just sometimes, you know, magnitudes. They're multiplicative magnitudes of difference. It's pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what do you think, I guess, besides hearing everything you've just laid out, how can we get basically America to move from the typical American diet of today, you know, fast food, burgers and all that, to eating more holistically, naturally? Basically, how can we get them to move their diet to how you raise your food? Like what do you think can move the needle?
The orthodoxy of our day, from the oracles on high, it poo-poos everything that I just said. and so there's a tremendous amount of inertia here. I explained to people that if people ate like I advocate, it would completely invert the power, position, prestige, and profits of the entire food and farming sector.
Mm. Yeah.
And that is a very, very big shift to invert, to capsize.
Mm. Yep.
So there's a tremendous amount of cultural, economic, emotional inertia to keep what we've done. I mean just think of the inertia as hydrogenated vegetable oil began to be questioned. More and more, look at the pushback in the food industry, the processing industry, to hold on to Crisco and hydrogenated vegetable oil, even while you know all the research showed that it was horrible, and butter and lard were significantly better. There was a lot of push to hang on to it, and of course now we know that whole whatever 50-year experiment was devastating to American health.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I'm getting ready to do a 4-day masterclass in Sweden next week.
Oh, wow.
And it's been quite the deal trying to get, you know, tickets and get through there. And, you know, I've traveled a lot over the last few years doing presentations around the world. And normally when you flash that American passport, that Passport USA, man, you're, you know, head of the class. I mean, everybody wants, you know, American visitors.
Mm.
Suddenly, you're a pariah. Nobody wants you. Nobody wants to let you off the plane. Nobody wants to let you through, you know, immigration.
Wow.
Even if you're just, you know, a layover. And so I've been thinking a lot about that. And, you know, why has the pandemic hit us worse than any other country? And I have to say that it's right in line with the fact that we lead the world in non-infectious morbidity. So not infectious morbidity. That's, you know, things like, you know, brucellosis and undulant fever and pneumonia, you know, communicable infectious stuff that are primarily from sanitation.
Right.
And so we don't have that because we have indoor plumbing and stainless steel refrigerators, and, you know, we're a fairly clean area. But what we've done is our pendulum has swung all the way from that all the way over to where we now lead the world in non-infectious diseases, diabetes, obesity, cancer, arthritis.
Wow.
Name your non-infectious.
That's so true.
Diseases that you can't catch from anybody else. And so, you know, there are places where you want to be number one. You know, you want to have the best Olympic team. You want to have the best football team. You know, there are places where you want to be number one. Well, leading the world in chronic non-infectious morbidity is not where you want to be number one.
No.
Wow.
And so the fact is that we are the least healthy. And yes, I'm including Kenya and Ghana and Nicaragua as a people group. We are the most unhealthy civilization in the world, and so it stands to reason that a virus that attacks immunocompromised people, especially, would be especially rampant in this extremely unhealthy culture.
But you don't see the media touching on that.
No, they're going after people and people's choices, not our nutrition. That is insane. I'm sitting here like mind blown, but it's also true. It's so crazy. I mean, so I guess my next question. So I'll list off my health.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I just can't help it because this is one of my favorite little lines now. What I want is somebody to just very nicely and gently push Dr. Anthony Fauci aside one time. And say, okay, America, here's what we're going to do. We're going to work on our immune systems for a week. But let's just spend 1 week working on our immune systems. Here's what we're going to do. We're not going to drink any Cokes or Dr. Pepper or Pepsi. We're not going to drink any sugary drinks this week. We're not going to eat any processed food. We're going to eat all food that you can pronounce, that you can fix in your kitchen. We're not going to go to McDonald's, the Hardee's, Burger King. We're going to actually, you know, eat at home using our techno-gadgetized kitchen to create stuff from its unprocessed state. And we're going to get outside for 1 hour a day, and we're going to exercise enough to build up a little bit of sweat for about 20 minutes a day.
Wow.
And we're going to drink a half a gallon of water a day so we can really get hydrated finally. Every American's, you know, short of hydration.
Yeah.
And then we're going to sleep for 8.5 hours a night. And finally, we're going to forgive everybody that you hate.
Yeah.
And we're going to do that for 1 week. Another one could be, you only get, if you watch the news, you have to double up. Whatever time you spend watching the news, you have to spend twice that much time watching comedy.
Yeah.
Stuff out and get your, you know, Greg Gildersleeve and the Abbott and Costello and I Love Lucy.
Aww.
And whatever it is that gives you a belly laugh, and you're gonna do comedy twice as much as the news. And you do that simple 6-step recipe for a week. Let's see how we all feel at the end of it.
Amen. It makes, wow. Yes. You know, a couple of years ago, so Cody and I have some close friends that are from Zimbabwe. They came to we graduated from Faulkner University. It's a small Christian college in Montgomery. And so these guys came over from Zimbabwe to play soccer. And one night, my dad's a political science professor at Faulkner. And so one of the guys had just gotten married, and his whole family came over to the U.S. for the wedding and all of that. He married an American girl, and my parents had them over for supper. And we were just getting to know his mom and dad and siblings. And I was sitting with his sister, this girl from Zimbabwe. She's sitting across the table from me. And I said, well, what's something that you've noticed about America in the 2 or 3 weeks that you've been here? And she said, you know, all I've seen lately is when I watch TV, every single commercial is about medicine. I mean, why do you need so much medicine? Just fix your food. And I remember, and this was before a lot of changes in what I've been doing for my personal health. I remember thinking, oh, that's kind of weird. Like, of all things you notice about America, that's the thing that you notice. But she's right. And so when she said that, I just started paying attention. And it's amazing how many medications are advertised, and literally all of them are like, can cause cancer, death, heart attack. Like all these horrible side effects to fix one problem in your body. And so I have a question to kind of add to this. So I've struggled with endometriosis, which is a hormonal imbalance, scalp psoriasis, and horrible gut issues. I've been told by doctors for years that I either have leaky gut or IBS. And I finally went to a holistic doctor who talked to me about changing my diet, adding supplements, all of those things. And even things that I thought I was eating that were good for me that weren't good for me. So if you're speaking to a group of people who've literally never heard any of this information that you're sharing, has never even come up with the idea that food could be the cause of their health issues, to anyone listening, if you could say one or two things that they could just change immediately and they would see health benefits, what would you list off of things that they could change about how they're eating or what they're eating?
Probably the first thing in America would be soda, you know, sugary drinks. I mean, one can of Coke has, I think, 16. I'm not sure whether it's tablespoons or teaspoons. Anyway, either one of sugar.
Wow.
And so that's one thing. I mean, just stop drinking sugar.
Yes. Amen.
that would be number one, and then number two, I would say, is to eat only foods that you can pronounce. So if there's something on the label that's some sort of a chemical, chemical designation, put it back. And if that means that you don't eat DiGiorno frozen pizza, well, that means you don't eat it, and maybe you eat an apple instead, or a peach, or a banana, anyway, get away as quickly as possible from unpronounceable ingredients. Those two things will. I mean, you know, we make sausage here at the farm. We sell pork sausage, and there's no MSG in it. There's no hydroxy, whatever. Everyone wants to say hydroxychloroquine now. we don't have that in our sauces. I don't think that's in the supermarket sauces. But anyway, you know what I'm talking about. All these long carbon chains that are chemically formulated. You don't need that stuff. You really don't. And that is those things, as Sina points out so well in Beyond. Beyond Label, mm-hmm. because she's the scientist of the two of us, she just goes into how those affect your nervous system, your microbiome, and what they what they do to you. So what you're looking for is pronounceable food.
Yes, that's awesome. Cody and I are actually about to move to North Alabama, to our family's farm. So we grow Empress Splendor oak trees and run cattle. And after going to your farm, we were very inspired. You actually answered one of my questions on the tour where I asked, what do you do if you're, if you only have cattle, if you don't have chickens and all the different elements, if you just have cattle. And we're actually going to implement rotational grazing, which we're super, super excited about. And we're already seeing benefits of just getting cows onto different paddocks, like seeing the
getting
effect.
The land rest. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's been such a game changer for us. And just getting to see this farm, you know, that my family has been a part of for so long. You know, my grandfather was a chicken farmer when I was a little girl, and I can remember going in those chicken houses with him and how horrible they smelled, and like walking through them with him and picking up dead chickens or killing the sick ones. And my dad told us on our way to Virginia, he said that when my grandfather bought into the chicken industry, which is so scary when I hear farmers say that they've bought chicken houses, because oh my word, it just sends them into so much debt. But that my grandfather stopped eating chicken because he noticed the difference in the food, what the company was telling him to feed the chickens, all of that. And, you know, my dad grew up with yard chickens. They just go outside and kill a chicken for lunch.
Sure.
And so when my grandfather started raising chickens, he stopped eating them because he knew how they were. And he just told my dad, he was like, that ain't normal. They're growing too fast. and so
yeah, I wrote a book by that title, folks. That's ain't normal.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Cody read it. Don't worry. And it's not normal. It's not normal. And the amount of sickness, you know, my parents even talked about it on the way to Virginia. We had a lot of time to talk because Alabama to Virginia is a long drive. But we talked a lot about how when they were kids, there was a lot less packaged food. There was a lot less just all the packaged and like the preserved foods were not at the same amount. And there are so many things that are diseases now that are on the rise that didn't even exist when my parents were kids. And that was in the late 50s, early 60s. And it's just, it's amazing. Your work and your studies and your farming methods and the things that you're sharing are truly helpful. They're helping people like me. I've been sick for nearly a decade and been trying to navigate what is wrong. Like, and reading in this book, hormone imbalances, infertility, all of these things are on the rise. And why? I know more women, I've met more women who have said, I have unexplained infertility. And it's been astounding the amount of people that I've met that are dealing with that. And it's making me begin to question, what is it that's going in our systems? So it's amazing and it's beautiful what you've done with your family's land, how y'all have fixed it. And one question Cody and I did come up with together is, you mentioned your dad earlier and how much you loved him and how he was just kind of gone too soon. If you had your dad here right now, what would you wish that he could see? Like, what do you wish that he, if he was here right now, that he could see that's developed with your farm?
Yeah, what I would love for him to see is, I would love to take him out and show him the fields. That were, when I was a child, I could walk them and never set foot on a piece of vegetation. You know, we could scarcely feed 10 cows. It was just the most barren, infertile, just horrible. And today, you know, we can feed 150 cows, and it's the most productive farm in the community. The rocks, the soil is built up over the rocks. And these fields that, you know, that when I was a teenager, I started raking hay, you know, I would rake 16 swaths to make a little tiny windrow. We'd make 100 bales off of a 12-acre field. Today, we make 2,000 bales.
Wow.
On the same field. And the windrows are so big, with just one rake swath, the windrows are so big you can't step over them.
Wow.
Just the sheer, so often farmers have this idea that nature is a reluctant partner, that and I'm saying nature, I'm God's creation, whatever. But
right.
But we have this reluctant partner that we must wrestle, you know, wrestle and subdue and force into some sort of submission. And our view is that what God has given us a loving partner.
Yeah.
And so the goal is not to wrestle, but rather to caress, and just caress in the right places. This loving partner wants to give us abundance. Mm. God's not wanting to withhold from us. He's
right.
wanting us to enjoy His grace and abundance in full, full plenty. So the idea is to look at His design and say, so how do we appreciate, how do we harness and leverage, like a masseuse, the natural healing and abundance proclivity of this loving, creative partner that God has given to us.
Yeah. Wow. That is such a good word. Wow. That's so true. And I feel like, as from our perspective of literally running cattle and just seeing, mm-hmm. like, you feel like you're in a constant battle with grass and having enough hay and having enough of everything. When if you work it and you stay consistent with it, it will give back to you exactly what you're giving to it. So that's mm-hmm. amazing. Is there anything else that you may want to just share before we wrap up?
Well, the only thing that I would share is, you know, encouraged someone or spoken to somebody's heart, my admonition is quit sitting on the bleachers. We don't have to be bystanders in this and expect somebody else to fix it, somebody else to make our world better. What we need to be doing is personalizing and metabolizing the message. So we come down off the bleachers, get in the game and participate. And to me, people ask, you know, what gets you up in the morning? What gets me up in the morning is knowing that when I go out there that back door and head out to chores, I am literally walking in to the privilege and honor of being the hand of God touching a physical manifestation of His grace. So many people feel disconnected from the world. They feel disconnected from creation. We go, what can I do? I can't really do anything. And I'm telling you that that everybody can viscerally touch God's creation in a way that moves it to healing or moves it to hurting. We can either practice redemptive interaction, or we can practice, hurtful, diminishing interaction. And so this is not something that we sit around and wait for somebody else to fix it. Somebody else, if all those people over there would just do the right thing, all those people over there, no, you know what? It's you and me, sister and brother, and it's up to us to participate in a way that will receive accommodation. Well done, thou good and faithful servant.
Yeah.
Amen.
Amen. Come on with it. You can preach a sermon on that.
Yeah, I've been known to preach a few
sermons. Yeah. Well, we thank you so much just for your time and your willingness to be on my podcast. This is going to be so fun to share. And this is a journey that Cody and I are still on, still learning about, still trying to transition our lives to. And so, anyways, you're a big part of that, and we appreciate you and your knowledge that you're just sharing with the world. So, anyways, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yes. Thanks for having me on, and blessings in your move and in your farming, and may you be richly blessed. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Same to you. You have a good evening.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Y'all, wasn't he so interesting? full of a lot of information in God's goodness. If you want to follow along with his farming ventures, check out Polyface Farm on Instagram, or you can subscribe to his newsletters and blog at polyfacefarms.com. Be sure to grab a copy of his latest book, Beyond Labels, or any of the many books that he has authored. You won't regret it. I will have links set up in the show notes for everything mentioned above on my website, laurabell.co. Thank you so much for being here today. I hope that you are filled up with hope without fear of the future.